Yo.
Oh, yes, whatever.
Angry old man speech.
Yeah.
Did you actually listen to any of that?
I did, yeah.
You did? Yeah. I couldn't. I heard, you know, snippets, clips here and there, and it's just so cringe-inducing.
Mm.
You really got to steel yourself just to...
Yeah.
Bear with it. Do you listen to the whole thing?
Yeah, no.
Okay, good. Yeah. You don't want to go full Biden.
No, never go full Biden.
You might end up just lashing out at someone, you know, kicking your dog or something. The anger is kind of so palpable. It's
transferable.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was quite remarkable in terms of the Biden we've come to know and loathe. He was a different guy, you know. It was presidential. It was a presidential moment. It reaffirmed his appropriateness or his capability to run for office this year and to take on Trump, you know, because he just, yeah, he was coherent, he was, you know, forthright, energetic. It was just cogent. It wasn't Joe Biden. At least the one we've come to know and love. So my first reaction was that he must have been on some kind of uppers, you know, over there.
Yeah.
Was there many available to...
He's jacked up.
People like him, so he was definitely, I'd say, on some kind of an upper, yeah.
Yeah. People noted that he was more lucid. Mm-hmm. That is, there were less gaffes when he was shouting the most.
Mm-hmm.
He was most focused.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was Alexander Mercouris who said, it reminds me the time when he was looking after his dying grandmother. She would lash out on him, like, left and right. He had dementia and other things going on. Mm. It was a bad turn, you know. But whenever she was most angry at him and everyone closest is when she was most focused. Otherwise, she was, you know, lost. Couldn't remember people, couldn't remember who she was, stuff like that.
Mm.
So there's some of that going on as well, for sure. It helps him focus, I suppose. But he's also just... who knows? Like, he's obviously reading a script. We know the script is written. I mean, the script then is published online after, of course. And the script is gaff-free. So he's trying to read it and he's getting it wrong. You know?
Yeah.
This guy ran against Trump, accusing Trump of being the divider-in-chief, that he would unite the country.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like... super divisive. State of the Union is historically, you know.
Yeah, come together.
Come together. Speak about the objective situation. Mm. Don't use it to get into party politics, especially if it's, you know, election year.
Yeah.
And it was a stump speech.
It was what?
It was a stump speech. You literally, like, spent the bulk of it, from what I read, bashing Republicans and Trump.
Yeah. But that's the climate we're in, you know. So it's, and it's hard.
Apparently 32 million people watched it.
Yeah, just to see. They were expecting to see him forget his lines and make mistakes and maybe fall over halfway through it, but he didn't. He was on some uppers, so he was good for the duration, you know. But that's the state of the Union, literally. It wasn't a state of... Was it officially a State of the Union address?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It just so happens to be at a key point in one of the key points in an election year, too. But
contrast that with Putin's sort of equivalent speech. There, it's his annual address to the Federal Assembly, but it's called State of the Union in the West.
Yeah,
last week, the week before, early March as well. And it's night and day. His was twice as long. Didn't have to shout.
Yeah,
in every detail about facts and figures and where it's going, where they hope it's going to go.
Yeah,
you know.
No, I mean, you have to. I suppose you have to allow for Biden's invective, because it's an election year, you know what I mean? Other State of the Unions are, you know, 3 out of 4 State of the Unions that a president gives are not an election year.
Mm.
So most of them, 75% of them, are let's all come together and let's be friends and not very divisive, but the ones in the election year tend to be a bit more anti my opponent, especially when it's Trump, you know?
We expect that now, but our expectations are lowered. Mercouris also pointed out he's read all of Abraham Lincoln's speeches, including ones during the Civil War, and there was no invective against the other side.
A long time ago, Neil. Long time ago.
Yeah, well, that's that. What we're normalized to, desensitized to, aggressive posturing,
mm-hmm.
narcissistic in the sense that it's all about him, what he's done,
mm-hmm.
not the country, it's not the State of the Union, it's me and mm-hmm. how my campaign is doing,
mm-hmm.
and all the people who are in my way,
yeah.
all the Republicans, Trump. He got Trump out under the first 3 minutes. Trump
yeah.
this, Trump that. 4 years in, it's still Trump's fault for everything.
Well, of course, it is Trump. It's Trump. Trump's the cause of this. You know, he would be able to give a nice hands across the divide speech if it wasn't for Trump, because Trump is coming to Trump's going to try and destroy American democracy and institute a dictatorship and. He's going to come after Robert De Niro and Bill Maher directly, personally.
Yeah,
yeah. Did you not hear that? It's only a day ago. Yeah, actually. Yeah, but best. It's a good summation. You have a listen to it here. A good summation of what certain people, the anti-Trumpers think of Trump.
The bottom line is, it's Biden versus Trump. We want to live in a world that we want to live in and enjoy living in, or live in a nightmare. Vote for Trump and you'll get the nightmare. Vote for Biden and we'll be back to normalcy.
Yeah. Yeah, because this is normal and it's not a nightmare.
So why is Trump winning? I mean, the New York Times poll this week came out, and maybe this will change it with the State of the Union address, but Trump was beating him rather soundly.
It didn't.
Quite a warning light, 48-43, also winning way more among women than he had before, winning outright Latinos. What do you attribute that to?
I don't know. I just don't want to
feel
the way I did, and many of us don't. After the election in 2016, where we couldn't believe that it happened,
he doesn't want to feel
a total
bad.
Monster. And
a monster.
Anybody, I don't understand it. I guess they get behind that kind of logic. They want to fuck with people, screw them because they're unhappy about something. He's such a mean, nasty, hateful person. I never play him as an
actor, as opposed to Biden,
because he's. I can't see any good in him. Nothing. Nothing at all. Nothing redeemable in him. And whoever the people are who want to vote for him, and there look like intelligent people around there, somebody, for some reason, it can't be. It cannot be. If he wins the election, you won't be on the show anymore. He'll come looking for me.
Everybody's laughing at him. Poor Robert, just pause there. So it's just more the same invective from. So.
Imagine being that sensitive that you feel persecuted.
Yeah.
Before any such persecution has even been like suggested.
Tough guy, you know, good fellas, taxi driver, actor, Robert De Niro is a big. Big pussy, a big snowflake behind the scenes. He's afraid that Trump's going to come after him. He's got a persecution complex.
That's why he acts the tough guy his whole life.
Probably, yeah. But he probably, he's all the things that he's accusing Trump of, basically.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He's probably a malignant, narcissistic type.
I believe
of which there are many, many in Hollywood. That's almost, it's almost a requirement.
You can't get in without
personality
it.
Requirement yeah. to be one. To be consummately... self-obsessed. The fact they have Robert De Niro, someone like that on, voicing the opinion of, well, I suppose he does voice the opinion of the people who are all about the fields, the sensitive, narcissistic type people who are all about their personal fields and they don't care about what's going on. And he doesn't understand, he said himself, he doesn't know why.
Yeah.
This people, a majority of people in polls are going to vote for Trump and he doesn't understand. They just want to fuck with people or something. But the bottom line is that he just doesn't want to feel the way he felt in 2016. He doesn't want to feel that again. And it's all entirely subjective. He should say, look, everything I'm saying here is entirely subjective. It's just my personal opinion based on my own psychological profile or whatever. I'm a weak, scaredy cat, Hollywood actor. And I'm just saying never Trump. So you can basically disregard everything I'm saying because it's all massively subjective and I'm not based in the real world at all. So thanks.
Yeah. The truest thing you said was that I cannot see what others see in him.
Hmm.
I believe him.
Hmm.
He actually doesn't have. It's not so much the vision. He has two eyes like everyone else, but he misses something internal that's unable to see.
Mm-hmm.
And there are millions and millions of people like that.
Mm-hmm.
They can't. They're stuck in some subjective chasm or something. And it's easy. I think they could ordinarily be cajoled or brought around.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as there's a media system that keeps them locked in,
mm-hmm.
nah, no chance. Unless things get really bad. I mean, there are breakthroughs. A country has to hit rock bottom, though,
mm-hmm.
for even those types to actually begin to see that their neighbor and their friends are suffering. But as long as he's surrounded by other rich people,
mm-hmm.
they can all, you know, live in their echo chamber,
yeah,
in relative peace. I'm thinking of Bukele, who was re-elected in El Salvador with 84% of the vote in early February.
Yeah.
He had the entire media against him. But still, a significant portion of that other type of people would have had to vote for him,
mm-hmm.
for him to get that 83%.
Mm-hmm.
Because the country was at rock bottom.
Right.
At least it was before his first term. You know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Nuts. Do you want to listen to any of the gaffes? The threat to democracy must be defended. That was one, but... The White House transcript corrected what he should have read off the teleprompter, which was, there remains the threat to democracy that must be defended, or something like that.
The threat to democracy must be defended. Yeah, he's, even on his uppers, he still wasn't able to...
No. Well, he doesn't open his eyes enough. They're small little black coals. I mean, if you look like that, like... Surely he should be wearing glasses mm-hmm. at his age, you know?
Yeah.
A little strike of Thomas Massie, Republican rebel in the House of Representatives. He brought along, you know, people bring along someone as a guest of theirs to stand in the, what do they call it? The upstairs part, the gallery.
Peanut gallery, yeah.
Peanut gallery. So Massey brought along Julian Assange's brother.
Nice.
Gabriel Shipton, brother of imprisoned WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Yeah. So anyway, what did he say of any substance? Well, he announced that the U.S. would, his idea anyway, was to build a port in Gaza.
Mm. Seaport.
A seaport to bring humanitarian aid.
Mm-hmm.
It's
better than dropping humanitarian aid on Palestinians' heads and killing them.
It's not realistic, though, is it?
None of it's realistic. None of it's sincere, yeah. So yeah, you can ignore it. It's virtue signaling, I suppose, in that respect. You know what I mean? It's not going to do anything. I mean, the whole thing's just it's pretty disgusting, actually. You know, the way the US is posturing about aid for Gaza and stuff when they're the primary reason, probably, well, they're second, let's say, behind Israel, but they go hand in glove for the fact that people in Gaza have been, you know, are being obliterated. Effectively, over the past four or five months, and a need of this kind of very ineffective aid, it's pretty disgusting. Like to watch them try and pass this off as some kind of a benevolent, we're going to help people of Gaza, we just destroy them, you know.
Yeah.
So
starvation is taking hold now. I mean, I don't know what the number. I think it's just several dozen officially. Officially, as best the numbers can be from Gaza, who've died from malnutrition so far, but that can obviously, you know, start slowly, and then hit a threshold where it becomes
mm-hmm.
Absolutely catastrophic. And they are starving them. We discussed it last week. Remember the sequence. The Jordanian government, I think together with the French, have been airlifting aid into Gaza for several weeks. They've done several runs of it where they parachute tons of boxes off. They do it, you know, on the coastline where it's relatively open. Some of them fall into the sea and some people swim out or go out in boats and they try and bring it back, right? They choose an open place, obviously, because it's safer to do that in case a parachute doesn't open. And then the Americans got wind of that because they realized it was a popular thing to do on social media in the Middle East. So they're like, let's get in on some of this good PR. So indeed, they began dropping aid. And as Joan mentioned, one of the airdrops killed Gazans. There's the first one, didn't even open, straight through buildings. They're starting to fall now on the open ground there. Look at how fast some of them are coming in. That's not what they're supposed to do. Jesus Christ. Straight between buildings. Yay, Team America. So, I mean, let's just... I know it's just one small thing, but it speaks volumes to everything that's wrong with this planet. I mean, the only reason they're doing that is to capitalize on some of the good PR Jordan's getting for doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they do it, they still kill people. Like,
okay. Yeah, symbolic.
Symbolic.
Their aid kills people. Well, yeah, because you've been killing people. The reason people have been down before,
because
the aid, because
your military aid to Israel,
right,
from those same airplanes,
right,
is so causing this. So what would be the best solution, Uncle Sam, is if you just went home.
Mm-hmm.
Just don't try to help. Just go away.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually the best answer in any given global issue. So, do you want to stick on? I mean, the main topic I was thinking of was Ukraine and what's going to happen from here. But we discussed that last week a bit. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, no change. Well, there is a change. I mean, the rhetoric about Ukraine is only getting stronger. Some updates first on what's been happening. It's becoming a daily thing now. Waves of drone attacks against Russia proper. Yesterday, Saturday, the Russian city intercepted 47 drones, fixed-wing drones, targeting regions south of Moscow. Earlier in the week, the Yukis were successful. I think they hit two large oil depots, causing fires. And I think on a separate occasion, two people were killed in Belgorod. At least large numbers of people aren't dying, but it's the frequency of drone strikes that are... That's definitely, it's escalated.
Mm-hmm.
We used to be talking about this once a month or something. Now it's almost daily.
The fact that it's an election year in Russia is a factor in that, you know, as well. In terms from the Yuki's point of view, you know, the best, they want to do their best to, you know,
make Russians not vote for Putin?
Well, yeah, I mean, as they say it, whatever, you know, kind of influence public opinion to make Russians suffer. They're going to be trying their hardest to make Russians suffer in the advance of the election, you know. It's also linked to the fact that they don't have much else. They can't do much, not doing much, aren't able to do much on the battlefield anymore in terms of winning any awesome victories or having any counter-offensives and stuff like that. So they resort to more sneaky, more backhanded attacks, you know, with the help of their Western allies, of course.
Yeah.
Sometimes directly facilitated by their Western allies. So, yeah.
And there have been some pretty big airstrikes in the other direction as well. Yesterday, now I'm confused. RT's reported that black and white footage of Iskander missiles as destroying two S-300 systems.
Mm-hmm.
But on Twitter, others are saying it was two Patriot systems that were taken out just yesterday, Monday.
Yeah, no, it's not just Twitter. It's on. It was reported in the Western press, actually.
Okay.
They put more or less, well, I mean, to the extent that a report in the Western press admits it, it was, this was from, well, this is probably just see this as a headline, but it's in Forbes. Forbes allows you to read their articles or not. I don't think they do, actually. There's not much, I mean, there's not nothing in the article, it's just the headlines enough in a certain sense, but
Russian drone spotted a Ukrainian, that should be in quotes, Patriot air defense crew, probably American, right?
Mm-hmm.
Convoying near the front line. Soon a Russian hypersonic missile streaked down. I don't know, is the Iskander hypersonic? If the Russians are correct that they used those, they didn't need a hypersonic missile. But they're talking it up, that that's how the Patriot was beaten, possibly, with that. Ukraine just really lost... That's bullshit, the byline is bullshit. Ukraine just lost its first Patriot launches, more like its 10th.
Yeah, if you scroll... You can scroll down a bit there, can you? Go down to... just below there, all that... all that is to say the Ukrainians lost in one calamity up to 13% of their Patriot launchers, or 7% of the Ukrainian batteries each have 8 launchers. But yeah, probably more. Of course, that's... and then if you scroll down, can you see the Twitter? No, you can't see any Twitter. Anyway, there's a war vehicle tracker that's from... an embedded tweet.
The footage of the strike?
Yeah.
I have it.
Yeah, have it here. Hang on. It's just the embedded thing. So it's supposedly German supplied, again, M901 launchers, but that's German supplied, but they're Patriot air defense systems, like US, were destroyed by a Russian Iskander ballistic missile. So
ballistic, it's not hypersonic.
Yeah. But this is the first confirmed loss of such. It's not confirmed, we talked about them in Kiev, just in the outskirts of Kiev. We had video footage last year sometime anyway.
Yeah.
There was of probably at least two or three Patriot missile systems. The interesting thing about this one, although we don't know about others, but they're obviously very covert about all of this in terms of the West isn't going to... It's surprising to see a Forbes article talking about it, kind of confirming it, but then I suppose it's hard to deny it. But yeah, it's very likely that those were manned by Western, possibly US, or if it's German supplied, maybe Germans. But anyway, NATO troops were the crews in them, and they're probably dead as well. So there you go. We're talking last week about, you know, or Macron again talking this week about sending NATO troops to Ukraine. Well, there's some of them in that video of the right in front of your face. There's some NATO troops very likely going up in smoke with that Patriot missile system. So what does Macron mean when he means sending troops? Is it what, sending them en masse? What, large columns of French troops marching across the Polish border? Under the flag of Bandera or something. I don't know what he means.
More on that in a minute. There was one other incident of note earlier in the week. There's another strike coming from the other direction, Russia into Ukraine. Remember, this deadly Russian missile struck close to Zelensky and Greek leader's convoy. So Zelensky was touring with the Greek prime minister in Odessa. And supposedly just after he left, or roughly at the same time, but down the road, 10 minutes away maybe, Russian airstrikes came in. you know what the Western press is like. There was bravado about how he'd managed to, like, the Russians were trying to hit him, but they'd avoided him. But that's nonsense, because the Russians released still some of their drone footage showing they knew exactly where he was. There was previously, actually, that's what it was. They had a drone following him overhead, and they released footage of that.
Previously.
Right.
Yeah.
Then the strike, they reported, TASS reported that what the strike hit was a warehouse in Odessa near the port, and that it took out a little factory where they've been making those sea drones that have been successful in sinking Russian ships.
Mm-hmm.
Russia says its forces struck warehouse doing sea drones.
So it was only incidental that, or maybe they timed it, but who knows? But it wasn't obviously an attack or a. Zelensky and the Greek Prime Minister, was it?
Yeah.
Obviously, they're not gonna take out the Greek Prime Minister, you know.
No, of course not. Well, no. They reserve that for others in certain situations, possibly. But they probably won't take out any leaders now. If you just go on a bit, I want to read the end of that third paragraph. According to the report, Zelensky's motorcade, which was 150 meters away from the Greek, was attacked by a drone. No, his motorcade was not attacked by a drone. It was watched by a drone, and then Russians published the footage to show you. We could at any time. We know where he is and stuff, but we didn't.
Hmm.
Okay. And of course, in the meantime, Russian troops are advancing all along the front a little bit, but more here, more in some places than others. And now, Macron and his Grande Armée. We heard this last week. We didn't dismiss it out of hand, but we're like, you know, okay, dude, you're just posturing, because, as you pointed out, we know there are NATO troops there. There was actually a statement by, you're right, that Scholz and even the White House just dismissed it out of hand, except for one guy. One person said, well, you know, I think that's a good idea, actually. The Polish foreign minister. He says, that's good. I like his thinking. The source here, I know, is Pravda, but it's from a Polish think tank video, which you can find on YouTube. So this is a true transcript of his statements. Western troops in Ukraine is not something unthinkable. Polish Foreign Minister Sikorski, remember, he's married to neocon warhawk Anne Applebaum. And his exact quotes were, scroll down. That is why I applaud the recent French initiative, because in my opinion there are good intentions behind it, namely to make the Russian president ask himself what our next step will be, strategic ambiguity and all that stuff, instead of allowing him to be certain that we will not do anything creative. There's something else, though. It's not just that he's agreeing with a potential idea. I'm not sure it's included in here, but I've seen others transcribe another portion in this kind of two-hour think tank video, which was all in Polish, so I can't verify this, in which he says, in a throwaway comment, quote, anyway, NATO troops are already in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
Not
new.
We can post the link to that YouTube video of the whole thing in Polish, and people can check themselves. I'm not sure where he said it in it and so on, but it's a real event, and he did say stuff, something like that. So, at least where we're going here, at least they're beginning to be a bit more truthy. And maybe that's part of Macron's thing, where he said, let us clarify what is going on. Let us not bullshit each other.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of heading in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
Also connected with this is that France last week, Macron hosted the leader of the Prime Minister of Moldova,
mm-hmm.
Sandu. Of course, she's a jumpy European liberal. She wants Moldova to join the EU to sign a defense pact. Something, eternal support, blah, 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 stop Russia. So Moldova, that brings in Transnistria, Odessa, Ukraine. Macron has since... He's not shutting up. Most people, most of the leaders may have said, oh no, that'll never happen. But he has since added to his comments that... I wondered about this. Was this kind of like a code or something? Kiev Post, Macron ready to send troops to Ukraine if Russia approaches Kiev or Odessa. If they do that, not now, where the front is over there in the east and southeast in Donbass and just north of Crimea, but if you go any further, if you're approaching, like if you come over the Dnieper and all the way to Moldova, then I wondered if that's not far off what you think the likely real politic endgame will be. It'll be like a splitting of Ukraine east and west.
Well, there was
a la Korea or...
Yeah, I mean, all of this speaks to, if we can look at a map in a minute, but all this speaks to kind of like that era. I mean, it talks... Well, we'll explain it in a minute, but look at this next article. This was from just this week. So in response to that one that that Putin, or sorry, Macron just received the Prime Minister of Moldova and pledged, we're going to support you forever, blah, blah, blah. And then Putin this week met with the, the main area of Moldova that people know about in terms of, you know, conflict between Russia and the East and the West is Transnistria, which is along the border with Ukraine. But there's another region, autonomous region called Gagauzia. she and this woman, Evgenia Gutul, the governor of Gagauzia, an autonomous region of Moldova, has spoken about her meeting the Russian president but during an anonymous visit to Russia. Basically, she comes back to Moldova and there's all sorts of suggestions about after her meeting with Putin and this, that she would be, you know, arrested by the Moldovan government, whatever. But, so if you just...
Interesting.
If you just... So, well, I'll explain in a minute what I think's going on, but Scott, if you just put this... Put that into Google. Put up Google Maps there, if you can, and...
So, Moldova is not going to make it, not as we know it. I mean, Romania claims Moldova. There's a part of Moldova already separate, de facto, and wants to be Russian, not Ukrainian, Russian, all the way through Ukraine. And then within Moldova, right, it's just ripe for splitting up.
Look at the map, though. Zoom out a little bit. A bit more. Yeah. So, do you have to put Gagauzia back in there so it'll come up? There you go, yeah. Okay, it's not... okay. Is it going to keep the red as you zoom out? No, anyway, it's this little area here. If you just scroll... It should do. Yeah, it does. So, that little red... Or if you scroll out a little bit more, or zoom out... Yeah, that's good. Okay, so there's Gagauzia. Transnistria, obviously, is along the border with Ukraine there. It's just all along the kind of eastern Moldovan border. And then you have this area down here, down at the bottom, which is another autonomous region of Moldova. This pro-Russian, the governor of it, met with Putin, as you just saw, this week. And, of course, then at the same time, you have the Prime Minister of Moldova itself coming to France and meeting with Macron, getting assurances that we're going to protect Moldova forever. And then she, this governor from this region, says we're aligned with Russia. And obviously Transnistria, Transnistrian rebels, as we call them, if you just put in Transnistria there, Transnistria.
That region is actually four little pieces.
Yeah.
I mean, this is crazy. This isn't going to...
Transnistria.
It's just ripe for breaking up.
It's not showing it, no? Okay. Zoom out a little bit. Okay. Anyway, Transnistria is along the border there. And so the interesting thing about this southern region, as I just showed you, is that, you know, Moldova is in the... has become more significant or more important for the West, the US, NATO, European countries in their war against Russia via Ukraine because of the state of play in Ukraine, with Ukraine being denied. It kind of getting to the point where it stays now where Ukraine, I think, like I said earlier on, Ukraine doesn't really have the ability to, it's really in defensive mode at this point. It's not getting enough funding or the same amount of funding as it was getting before, or the same amount of weapons as it was getting before. So the tide is kind of turning in that respect. Russia's on the in the ascendant in Ukraine, and so this is evidenced by, apart from what we know on the actual battlefield, but in terms of the political manoeuvring going on around it, they're worried about Moldova, which tells you a lot, you know what I mean, in a certain sense. That it could tell you that they're concerned of Russia at some point in their future. If you just zoom out a little bit so we can see Ukraine and all of Ukraine. So they're concerned there that, you know, Russia might end up rather quickly, relatively quickly compared to the way it's gone up until now, moving, taking potentially large swathes of Ukraine. So they're worried about Moldova. So, I mean, that could be one aspect of them talking about NATO troops in Ukraine, maybe NATO troops in Moldova. They're worried about these breakaway regions of Moldova, you know, maybe turning on Moldova, let's say. There's Russia maybe stoking some kind of internal divisions, which obviously exist within Moldova, and Moldova falling, the government being overthrown in Moldova, and then suddenly you'd have all of Moldova, as you can see there, possibly being a Russian protectorate, and that would be bad news, because then, you know, fairly quickly you would have a, you know, Ukraine would be caught in a certain, at least the southern area of Ukraine would be caught in a pincer movement, and you could have Odessa taken, who knows, from...
Odessa, which you've all heard Medvedev say is a Russian city, i.e. was founded under Catherine the Great. Moldova, as you, that name is modern. That didn't exist before. It was Bessarabia. It was an autonomous region within the Russian Empire. The Russian Empire kind of ended there, at the current border there between Moldova and Romania. That's why there are so many Russian speakers, or people that see, or identify as Russian, all the way down that beginning of the western side of the Black Sea region. Russia doesn't even need to take anything here per se. I mean, it will, with respect to Ukraine, that's likely. They've almost said as much. But when you get beyond that, it's not so much about taking as... Here's some cultural context. Keep going, go skip past Romania and go down to Bulgaria. So you're like, that's far away from Russia. I'll never be part of Russia. And I agree, you'll never be part of Russia. But here are some of the ties that exist. Last week, 2 weeks ago, Bulgarians celebrated their national holiday. Their national holiday celebrates the liberation of Bulgaria from the Ottoman Empire, which Russia did. And when they went through some big landmark, like a memorial, a monument, typically the prime minister gives a speech at the event. He was booed, roundly booed, because he's pro-West, pro-NATO, blah, blah, blah. And there's a sea of thousands of people, and they're waving Bulgarian and Russian flags. That's the cultural reality of Bulgaria. You know what I mean? This is what they're fighting against. And it's an unwinnable battle for minds.
Mm-hmm.
And Russia doesn't need to come in to protect or save at least those people. It might feel it's been requested to by people in Transnistria. They specifically asked, can you help us? We're a bit nervous here. So that might turn into an actual military slash occupation slash liberation. But elsewhere, it's more like there's no need for big Arab movements for Russia to come in to save, quote, their Slavic peoples or fellow Slavs or people who think themselves as Russian, because they just need to hold the line and let the desperation in the West try to cement their version of reality, which in Moldova's case would be Brussels and Washington and London saying, you get into the EU and NATO ASAP. And as the protests grow in your country because they think more like Russians, just do it faster. You know what I mean? And it's going to create its own perpetual problem.
I mean, there's no need to do it.
Kremlin doesn't have to do anything. And they'll be accused of influencing those people. But that's an influence of history. They don't have to do anything to make that happen.
In Moldova, you mean?
Moldova, Bulgaria, wherever.
Yeah, I don't think... Yeah, I mean, who knows? But Bulgaria's... could happen. But I mean, the focus on Moldova and those two regions of Gagauzia and Transnistria is that it relates directly, potentially, to strategically to Ukraine, yeah. to the conflict in, yeah. conflict in Ukraine. Those would be definitely areas that it would be useful for the Russians to, you know, to feel the need to, I don't know, intervene in, let's say, militarily. It's kind of like Crimea in a certain sense. They could plausibly say these people, in fact, that's what that the governor of it was going to spoke with Putin about this week, about, you know, violations and what did she say, breaches, she breached the procedure, and what else? Let me see. She added that Putin had promised to support Gagauzia and Gagauz people in defending our legitimate rights, powers, and positions. She said, I informed Vladimir Vladimirovich about the lawless actions of the authorities in Moldova who are taking revenge on us for our civic position and loyalty to national interests, alleging violations of legal rights and destabilization in Gagauzia and the whole country. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not... it's when you see that happening, you know, it's not... It's not just by accident that that's happening right now, right? And there's also stuff in the news about rebels, so-called rebels, or, you know, separatists, let's say, in Transnistria, calling on Russia to support them and that kind of stuff, you know? So, and then you have the Europeans freaking out about Ukraine in general, talking about sending troops to Ukraine and hosting the Moldovan president in Paris. So, yeah. Those are the kind of things you look at and you go, yeah, this is indicative of a sentiment behind the scenes about how the conflict in Ukraine in general is going. And it's not going very well for the West. They're very, very, very concerned. They're very unhappy.
Yeah. it's not just politicals making these statements about expanding the war as well. This is from a French general this week, puff piece in political.eu, French soldiers training for the killing fields of Europe. And this is a quote from this senior French colonel. The world has revealed its true nature, unstable, dangerous, and not everyone is a friend. So, okay, Western man, you just realized that because things aren't going your way now. Everything before, I suppose it's kind of like the jungle statement from Borrell. We in Europe are in a garden where everything's been rosy.
Yeah.
Out there it's bad, but it's starting to come in, you know.
That should be twisted. That should be turned around. What he, you know, senior French colonel should, his statement should have been, you know, the West, particularly the West and its allies, the US and its allies have revealed their true nature, unstable, dangerous, and no one's friend. They've never been anyone's friend. It's always been do what we say or else. And now that's not going well for them anymore, and they're starting to cry and whimper and say, look how mean you're being to us. It's kind of pathetic, you know. But it's so interesting. Like, I mean,
it's trickling down to rank and file. They're being told psychologically to prepare themselves for going mano-to-mano with Russian army.
Yeah. Well, if any of them are stupid enough to do it, then go ahead. Like, but... I don't think, that's like I said last week, I don't think there's going to be much in the way of uptake of, I don't think it'll be a cakewalk to send a significant amount of European or NATO troops from Europe in particular, or even the US to Ukraine. You might get more Americans to go, because they've got a bigger army, a bigger pool of people to use. But in terms of like French, German, Italian, Spanish, Polish maybe, you know, you might get some Poles to go. Probably a bunch of Estonians ago, Latvians, yeah.
For sure.
But there's not many of them, you know, they'd last a couple of days or whatever, you know. So in terms of like the bulk of major European countries that could supply a significant enough army, I'd be surprised if they were able to muster a significant amount of people to actually be willing to go, that there wouldn't be a lot of dissent among the ranks to the idea of going and actually fighting and dying for Ukraine against Russia. I don't think that's stupid, you know. It depends on the country, and it would be, you know.
Sweden and Finland just joined NATO formally this week.
Yeah, joining NATO is one thing, but...
They looked... Oh, well, that's... You're you're putting yourself in position to join. The reason you're joining at this point is because Russia's about to invade, right?
Well, it's yeah, but
that's what they're telling Swedes in the press, huh? The impression in Swedish homes.
Yes, but it's not about invasion. It's about going
right
to fight Russia. That's very different.
Well, we have to go there to fight them there before they come here.
No, but that doesn't work. That's very different. I mean, it's you join NATO, and it's one thing when a country invades your country, then you get a lot of people to sign up, or more people anyway, to sign up to go and repel the invader.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a totally different equation in the given in this particular context, where to try and get French troops, for example, to go and march or fly or whatever into Poland and then cross the border into Ukraine and start shooting and dying against Russian troops. That's a totally different equation. Like
mutiny?
No, just dissent in the ranks and people not interested in going. You know? I mean, you can't force people to go either, can you?
That's true. It emerged this week that it's in French, so I don't know what if you play. There's no subtitles, but it's very clear. So this retired French general was on radio/TV, Sud Radio in France, and he claimed that the head of the army at the time in France told him that Macron had called him up sometime at the peak of the Gilets Jaunes rebellion and asked him to please start opening fire on the protesters.
Hmm.
And the general told him, no, monsieur, that we don't open fire on
I doubt. Macron asked him to do that?
That's what he claimed. Yeah.
Here's a picture of the newest, these are some of the newest NATO members. Here's a picture of them outlined on the map. So that'll work out well. Some schoolboy humour there. Always good. So you can take that down now, Scotty.
Final piece of Eastern European news for me. Latvia has begun expelling Russians because they refused to Latvianize. They were given a time limit to, as part of finally being accepted as full Latvian citizens after 33 years of being Russians who were caught on the other side when the USSR fell. They just decided to start expelling them because the Russians are refusing to take a compulsory language course to speak Latvian and some other requirements for citizenship. So they're a minority. I'm not sure what it is in Latvia. It's higher in like Estonia. There's something like more like a million people who would be Russian or of Russian origin. In Latvia, it's smaller. That's freedom and democracy for you. But I think it speaks to how scared they are. Because remember the justifying principle Putin gave for Ukraine, or one of, was they may not be within the borders of our country, but they're Russians, and we're going to defend Russians. But see, the collapse of the USSR left Russians everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So everywhere where there's a minority of Russians, they've got to be thinking, okay, what if we just push them out? They're no longer here, and then you won't come, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of the whole thing's. It's weird how they keep engaging in these kind of self-fulfilling prophecies. You know, they talk about all along the shade they've thrown at Russia has been that Putin he was very unhappy about the fall of the collapse of the Soviet Union and he wants to rebuild it. There was no evidence of that whatsoever, but they said it anyway to try and scare people. And of course, they're still saying that today. And that's the dominant narrative today is why Russia is in Ukraine is because Putin is trying to recreate the Soviet Union. But then, by opening that door, by provoking Russia, as most people should understand, the reason why Russia invaded Ukraine was because Ukraine was being turned into a NATO base from which it could, first of all, dominate and probably mass murder people in the Donbass, and then attack Russia in some way or other. So Russia had to do something about it. So in provoking,
like we're seeing now, maybe drone attacks.
Yeah. So in exactly. So in provoking Russia into doing that, then it brings other areas into play, any that are strategically important, and that includes Moldova, for example, because there's a breakaway republic there, and it's strategically important in terms of the conflict in Ukraine. And you said, obviously Moldova was part of the Soviet Union, and if Russia or Putin or whatever shows any interest in Moldova or any movements towards Moldova, then it'll be like, see, we told you, he's trying to recreate the Soviet Union, when in fact, just inane. The whole line of argumentation is just inane.
It's their actions. They're all Robert De Niro's, though. Yeah. Everything that happens will be confirmatory in their minds because they can't see otherwise.
Right.
And they drive you mad if you actually try and reason with them, but you can't. It's like someone who's just able to see it and someone who isn't, and you're trying to explain to them. No, they're always going to see it their own way.
Right. Did I say that, Scotty? Yeah. This is, just to understand, we're talking about Macron, Ukraine. So Macron is the one who said there a week ago or so that doesn't rule out, you know, we might send troops to Ukraine, French troops to Ukraine, and everybody jumped on him and said that's a bad idea. And then some of them are rolling it back now and saying, well, there are already NATO troops in Ukraine, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, here's the explanation to some dude. It's got subs on it, so Russian and then English. Well,
vous n'êtes pas en train de manger à votre table, mais vous n'excluez pas d'aller manger dans votre table à un moment donné. Parce que vous allez vous manger, c'est les mêmes.
You see, it's the same thing. Wonderful analogy there. It's because you're standing. It's like standing in front of a table.
So glib.
You're standing in front of a table. It doesn't mean you're going to eat, but you could eat at some point because you ultimately will go and eat something at the table. But if you're standing in front of the table, it doesn't mean that you're going to eat it. But the fact that you're standing in front of the table means that you probably will eat at some point, and that's meant to be an explanation of how he was misunderstood, which doesn't really. I kind of summed it up that way, you know. Not ruling out something does not mean doing it. The diminutive closet homosexual said. Using an analogy, he said it was like standing at your dinner table but not eating. You don't rule out eating, and you may well eat later. So France's involvement in Ukraine is just like eating. But yeah, it's a good analogy because they're just feasting on the situation in Ukraine. Ultimately, these people, they're like vultures.
It's such a glib,
yeah,
comparison. It's like, oh. It's such a serious topic, and you got to wonder, does he understand the implications of what he's saying?
Mm-hmm.
If he can just refer to something so banal.
Yeah.
To he thinks, educate people.
Yeah, but you have to take that seriously. When you look at him saying that, you have to take it seriously, what he's, and by take it seriously, I mean you take seriously the fact that he doesn't give a shit. None of these people actually give a shit. None of them care. It's not serious to them, you know. It's all just eating analogies and, you know, playing and getting what they want out of it and that kind of stuff. Doesn't mean that they won't do certain things, but it's like a clown show. It's like being run by idiots, basically. It's like a country being run by idiots. And I think that's a big problem a big mistake people make. Whenever they listen to the words of their elected leaders, particularly in the West, but really anywhere, but particularly in the West, at the current time, they take what they say as being the words of someone who is actually kind of compos mentis or intelligent and knows what they're doing. These people are, they're not idiots in the classic sense, and they're not like retards, they don't have a very low IQ, but they're not serious people. They're not serious about anything that they're doing. They're in it for themselves. You know, it's difficult because.
But their words and actions have serious consequences.
They do, but not. But people shouldn't. People should take them as the words of someone who is an insincere person with very few morals and is just, you know, trying to sound like they're a responsible person, but they're not a responsible person. And that makes it, that gets complicated then because you don't know if they're actually going to follow up on what they say or not. You know what I mean? They may or they may not, but one thing you can be sure of is that they're not doing it for the reasons they say they're doing it, whatever they do. And generally speaking, what they do, because they're not sincere in what they're doing, they will end up making a mess of things. It'll never work out the way they claim or think it'll work out.
Yeah, well, this very month, 210 years ago, Napoleon had it, the culmination of his idea, which was that we go to Moscow, resulted in the very opposite. The famous paintings of the moment when the Russian Tsar, Alexander I, led an allied army of which Sweden was a part, incidentally. The last time Sweden was actually part of any alliance, 210 years ago, which they just ended this week by joining NATO, Alexander first led the army into Paris, which was the first one that unseated Napoleon, who of course came back a year later, but no one expected that in France just, what, 6 months before. So yeah, you never know what's going to happen. I mean, I'm not suggesting history will repeat the same way, but the echoes with the past and today, they're not way off. You know?
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of the week, there was this kerfuffle. UK-US embassies in Russia warned of imminent terror attacks. And by imminent, they actually warned their staffs in both embassies that they basically take shelter, don't go out, because there's going to be a terror attack today, within the next 24 hours. The UK and US embassies in Russia. Ah, rats, no, it's not that. I must have taken it from one of those latest annoying articles where they have, like, the news bite produces a headline and then they change it depending on the latest one. Anyway, people probably heard about it. The security alert urged them to avoid large gatherings because a terrorist attack could take place in Moscow within the next 24 hours. And specifically, the claim was that they heard that ISIS was going to target a synagogue, attack Jews in Moscow. But then why would the embassy staff have to, you know, not leave, you know? What's going on there? Do you have, is it just another thing? I mean, this happens now and then with with Moscow. I mean, in the space of 48 hours, there was indeed an FSB raid south of Moscow,
mm-hmm.
which they produced footage of, and it supposedly this was the ISIS-K group from mm-hmm. Afghanistan mm-hmm. who were going to target a synagogue in Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, or just the day before, up north near Finland's border, the FSB again produced footage of them shooting dead, because they said he shot at them,
mm-hmm.
a Belarusian radical nationalist who had been recruited by the SBU to carry out a terror attack in Russia. That's why I'm like, this happens all the time, but for some reason last week the British and American governments
funny how
made a big deal out of this one, particular
yeah.
warning.
Yep, it sent a signal, right?
It's authorship, there's something authorship going behind it. Yeah, this.
It's trying to unnerve the Russian government, make them, I mean, they're well aware of the fact that, you know, phony terrorists or false flag terrorism, let's say ISIS-K, whatever, different jihadi groups in the pay of Western intelligences are, you know, have been used in many different places. I mean, the Russians are probably one of the best informed about the nature of that. So when they hear ISIS-K and then they see the ISIS-K plot to blow up a synagogue in Russia. Why don't they blow up a synagogue in Israel, for example? ISIS-K, I mean, that seems like the ISIS-K don't, from ISIS from Afghanistan don't like Jews, right? What are the Jews doing these days? I mean, the Israelis. What are Israelis doing over the past 4 months? Where would your ire be if you were anti-Israeli or anti-Jewish? Where would your particular ire be right now? I mean, would it be anywhere near in the land of Israel? Maybe, you know, maybe get in there somehow, sneak in with a bomb or whatever, blow it up. But instead you want to go to Moscow to blow up a synagogue in Moscow? Why? Because Russia has a good relationship with the Jews, with the Jews of Russia, whatever. There's a good, Jews are well integrated into Russia. Is you'd want to upset that or something? Doesn't make any sense. And then you have the Western embassies and stuff talking about, you know, telling their people, residents of our countries, don't go there. We have information directly from our intelligence who are running these ISIS cells exactly. in Moscow that they're going to do stuff. So it's just pretty pathetic. Like, you know, I mean, yeah, and I suppose it's just
transparent.
It's just to send a message, really, I think.
I wondered if it was to do with this, because the week before, Lavrov said something interesting. The Russian Foreign Ministry had issued a summons to the ambassadors of certain embassies, I presume including the American and British ones, to a summons means a day, like a day march. You must come because we have questions. And the questions he wanted to ask them was about their meddling in Russia's upcoming elections. And they just refused. And that he said, that's not the way you're supposed to come. Al Jazeera headline, Russia accuses Western ambassadors of meddling in internal affairs. Moscow hit out at envoys, claiming they refused to meet with the foreign minister. If you scroll down...
Which ambassador?
We'll see now.
Ambassador from the European Union countries. Just from European Union countries.
Lavrov said March 4th he'd invited EU envoys for a conversation, but they had refused. And then he comments, the question indeed arises, what are they doing and why, and how do they interpret their conduct on the territory of our country if they do not perform the most important function? I read elsewhere that he was, maybe it was someone's guess, maybe I didn't read it as a quote from him or from Zakharova, that they would hint at just basically closing their embassies. If all you're going to do here is just cause trouble and then, you know, refuse to meet us, you're not an embassy.
Mm-hmm.
You're supposed to be a mediator between, you know, sides.
Yeah.
So, the whole, I suppose if there is a larger point to all of this, well, there are several, there's economic, of course. One of the things stated ad nauseum at the beginning of this in February 2022 was to isolate Russia, right? The sanctions were supposed to isolate it. The sporting and cultural boycotts were supposed to isolate it and stuff like that. It's absolutely not working. Every year there's the World Youth Forum. I don't know who, maybe it's a UN thing. Happens in Sochi. I don't know why it always happens in Russia, but it attracts like thousands of people. From all over the world. Happened again this week, and I think Putin was in attendance. Last week there was some other forum, a multipolar event, something forum, that had loads of like anti-imperialist, roughly pro-Russia people from Jackson Hinkle, the American guy, what's her name, Syrian girl coming from Australia, meeting in Russia and discussing multipolarity, world futures, stuff like that. So isolation, it's such a dangerous game they're playing, that it all banks on, they stress Western cohesion, but it has to be a lot more than that. Here's how someone in France is thinking about it. You remember Dominique de Villepin?
Foreign minister.
He was a foreign minister under Chirac. This is a guy who basically, this is like the president France should have had, really. He is renowned statesman, diplomat, very well spoken, intelligent, etc. Well, he was kind of ousted in a contrived scandal in the run-up to the 2007 election, and instead Sarkozy became president. Sarkozy brings France into NATO, and that's all she wrote for France, basically. 10 years later, it's ISIS terrorism, and here we are today where France is the cheerleader for NATO actions against Russia. Well, he's still alive and he's still talking. Well, he was on French TV last week and he warned that, among other things, that even if you take Macron's proposal semi-seriously, right, even if an escalation of the war can be contained to conventional army versus army, Russian army versus NATO forces, the Russians could draw, he's worried, he was pointing out that one of the unforeseen consequences of that would be that Russia can draw on support from the global south. You know, okay, so you can draw, or you believe, Joe just said that's unlikely, they're going to refuse, but they believe that they can attract a certain number of NATO forces to go and do it. Okay, on the Russian side, they will have no problem bringing people from all over the world. And well, the Western media, they already are to some extent. The Western media can, you know, run hit pieces on how Russia is exploiting Nepalese and Africans in the ranks of their volunteers. You know, they duped him into getting there. There's all kinds of stories like that in the press whenever they do mention the fact that it's not just Russians fighting on the Russian side in what is almost a global war. If it escalated to this next level and Macron got what he wanted, he'll catch a tiger by the tail, de Villepin's warning, because who knows? Look at all those coups and revolutionary type things that have happened in Africa. Mm-hmm. What happens in all those countries? Everyone's seen the footage. The people are in support of the army and they're all waving Russian flags.
Mm-hmm.
Lavrov goes on a tour of the world, whether he's in Latin America or Africa or Asia. He's popular everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They don't understand what they're doing. Even if they think they can keep it contained to below the threshold of mad, where Russia doesn't feel so threatened that they're going to start using nukes, because otherwise there's no more Russia.
Mm-hmm.
If they think they can keep it Ukraine-level, conventional war, war of attrition, just next level, that's something that could happen. You would have basically, he was saying there are already people who are motivated to be fighting in Ukraine to get at the West. I don't think that was a crazy thought to have. So they would be, for example, African from ex-French colonies.
Mm-hmm. You mean like irregular armies?
I don't know to what extent they're integrated, or if they are themselves trained in any way and then they go and volunteer, or they're just out and out volunteers.
So a volunteer corps within the Russian army?
Yeah.
Who would be the ones to actually fight against or NATO invade NATO? Invade NATO countries or fight against
NATO?
But I don't think you have any problem getting... This is the difference. You wouldn't have any problem... It's kind of like... You wouldn't have any problem getting Russians to fight against French or NATO forces in Ukraine, because they'd be seen as the one, despite the fact that it maybe sounds counterintuitive, NATO forces would be seen as the ones invading Ukraine. So Russian forces who are in Ukraine would have no problem. You know what I mean? There wouldn't be the same reticence. It's like none of the regular force, none of the regular army in any of the NATO countries, at least in Europe or even in the US, are actively involved in direct contact, if you know what I mean, regular direct contact with Russian forces. So to get them to start doing that, to get them to like invade, to get significant numbers of NATO military personnel from European countries to actually invade and start fighting and dying for what? It's the reason that's missing. You know what I mean? Sure, maybe military personnel, a lot of them aren't the smartest people, whatever, but they still have to have a good reason. You know what I mean? 9/11 got hundreds of thousands of US military personnel and most of the population behind an invasion of Iraq and invasion of Afghanistan because they were attacked and because there was a rationale. The average NATO military soldier today looks at the situation in Ukraine and probably has a reasonable enough understanding of what's actually going on. And unless Russian troops were to actually invade into European countries, I think they would not put their name down for spontaneously going far, you know, en masse, officially into Ukraine and directly trying to... Because they're not fighting... Russian soldiers are well enough aware that their involvement in Ukraine is for protecting their homeland and protecting their people. What protection, what kind of rationale, similar rationale, would a French soldier have for fighting Russians? Who's he protecting? Some bullshit political kind of, notion of protecting the
democracy,
the world order, or something like that, yeah. or the you know, but
the rules
soldiers,
order.
Soldiers don't go to fight and die on that basis, by and large. That's some political nonsense. I mean, it's people like Macron live in the rules based order. They're around the table of the annual meeting of the international community, the rules-based order. He, Macron, when he talks about that and the rest of them talk about it, they're talking about it from their own political survival and political self-interest. And they're trying to transfer that down to the average soldier. He says, yeah, you go and fight for me to remain sitting at this big, nice, white marble table with all of my other Illuminati types. No thanks. I mean, a soldier will go and fight for to protect his homeland, protect his people, his family, his friends. You're not going to get them to do it for some jumped up notion of protecting the Western rules-based international golden billion freedom and democracy order. I mean, they're not that stupid, you know what I mean?
Well, British and American ones have done a lot of that.
But they always had a rationale, like, when it was boots on the ground and you're going to die, they've gone, they've been involved. I mean, sure, a pilot will go and drop some bombs on Libya or something, or drop some bombs in Syria. But they understood that's why you didn't have boots on the ground in those situations. The most they could get out of 9/11 was Afghanistan and Iraq. And even with Iraq, they were stretching it. But they got there because it was still relatively recent after the 9/11 attacks. So the fields were still there and they were going to avenge. They weren't going to protect freedom and democracy. They weren't going to bring freedom to Iraqis. They were going to avenge the people who died in 9/11. Somehow, and this is where the stupidity comes in, somehow Bin Laden was maybe hiding out in Iraq. Something Bin Laden, Saddam, friends,
weapons of mass destruction.
9/11 times 1,000 again. Yeah. Just remember 9/11. You know, if you have any concerns about invading Iraq, or you don't want to invade Iraq, you know, the average soldier, then just watch another video of the planes hitting the Twin Towers, and then you'll feel better about it. I think it's, there may be some, I think the potential for contact or some kind of escalation of the conflict in Ukraine with, you know, more direct contact with NATO troops or something is maybe over the border type stuff, or something in Poland, something maybe in some of the
Romania,
something in many of the Baltic states, as a result of some attack against Russia, where the Ukrainians are, well, they're easily led into this, but that their NATO handlers, their Western handlers, allow them to, you know, or facilitate them to attack Russia in a more direct way, and Russia then sees it as, well, listen, you know, you've crossed one of our red lines here, and they maybe then attack one of their decision-making centres outside of Ukraine. There'll be a lot of, like, scaremongering at that point. Oh my God, this is it, this is the start of it. Putin's going to invade, you know, he hit a NATO military base in Poland or in Estonia or one of the Baltics or wherever, and this is just the beginning, you know. But then say, oh wait, there isn't a mass build up of any troops on the Russian border, so apparently not, and then it'll all fizzle out, you know. So these people are full of hubris and their own self importance and nothing, and they just enjoy their drama queens, you know. I mean, you know, do I need, they're literally drama queens, do I need to, maybe I need to emphasise, and, you know, this is again Macron, but when I say drama queens, I mean, this should underline that point. This is who you're dealing with. These are the great war generals. Here's a great war general of one of the NATO countries, right? So, you know, in the same way that when Western politicians would tell American troops, you know, if you don't want to invade this country, think about 9/11, watch the planes hitting the towers again. When people say, oh, you know, NATO's going to invade Russia and there's going to be nuclear war, I'd say, just have a look at this picture. And then tell me that there's going to be, these are going to be the great generals who are going to invade and have a great conflict with Russia. They're not. So that's him and his troops. There's the French troops that are going to be invading Russia. That's all of them, actually. That's a full battalion right there.
All right, point taken.
And include, what do you call her? She'll be there too. His grandma.
Handing out cookies.
His grandma will be handing out cookies to the... handing out fried chicken. Fried chicken and watermelon.
Speaking... You're on a roll, okay. Okay, so what you're saying is, yeah, let them do their worst, it'll go nowhere. But you agree that they seem panicky and desperate, and they're dangerous, because they have nukes, and, I mean, nukes, they have a lot of other weapons too.
Yeah, push some buttons, they're not allowed to use their nukes. There's a higher power says you're not allowed to use your nukes. So, it's not going to happen. Escalation doesn't happen easily. We should know. We've learned that from the Middle East as well.
Yeah.
Look at all the opium.
I know. We thought
Lebanon and Iran and all this kind of stuff. We're going to get Israel.
It is escalating, but it's much more gentle escalation.
Look what they're getting away with. When it's coming down to the Houthis. The Houthis are the ones who have to carry. Have to stand up and actually do something. However, ineffective it is to actually take a stand. So
they sunk another ship. Have they sunk it or they hit a ship and they killed three people? First deaths, I think, on actual civilian ships. This time they claimed it was a U.S. cargo ship. But the media reporting about it, it's always like, no, it's Liberia-owned and the flag is Belize.
No, it was still American, though,
and they seem to know exactly which ships are owned ultimately by U.S. or British interests. That's remarkable.
You can trace it back.
So they hit another one this week. Plus, undersea cables. They deny that, but they were cut last week, four specific fiber optic cables. There's different types of cables in the sea. I was reading that you can get actual power transmission lines, and then you've got the more
actual data
fiber optic for internet and comms. And they hit four specific comms ones, which may or may not have affected Israel more than other places. That's supposedly the idea. However, unlike the strikes they've carried out against either Anglo-American warships or civilian cargo interests, in this case, they deny doing that. It did happen. We know that. And Facebook and Instagram were down for ages that day. May have been connected. But in this case, their official word is no, it wasn't us.
Who, the Houthis?
The Houthis, yeah.
Yeah.
They're being sneaky about this one. So they can be sneaky too.
They can, yeah.
I guess.
Did you see... I want to move on to wildfires. Did we talk about wildfires last week in Texas? No?
I mentioned it at the end of the show, yeah.
Yeah.
The scale of it. It's the biggest ever for Texas.
Yeah, kind of crazy. Here's...
put out by snow. The weather didn't seem like...
Here's Abbott talking about them. And the governor of Texas talking about those fires.
I have witnessed and observed some extraordinary damage in our state. It could be caused by hurricanes or tornadoes, and frequently when you see the aftermath of that damage, there's some semblance of a structure that is still there. When you look at the damages that have occurred here, it's just gone. Completely gone. Nothing left but ashes on the ground. Some early, and I will categorize as premature assessments, show that there are about 400 to 500 structures that have been destroyed. There's no way to say for certainty that's going to be the final number, because there's still the ongoing assessment process.
Yep. So he's a bit confused by it. And then, of course, the...
But if a fire is not strong enough, American houses are made of wood. Won't it just, it'll burn to the ground. I didn't understand what he was...
Foundations.
Which would be not wood.
Well, I don't know, but it depends. He's talking about structures. Well, he's not just talking about houses. He's talking largely about like ranches and not only about houses, but about ranches and cattle farms and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And... You know, they've obviously have other materials. They're made of steel and all that kind of stuff, you know. But
so he's suspicious.
He's suspicious. He's obviously seen
something unusual.
Yeah. And, of course, the answer is, of course, as usual, this.
Space lasers.
No. Official story. You talking? What are you talking about, Neil?
Well, I was on Twitter and everyone's talking about Jews. Not J-E-W-S. D-E-W-S.
So, Powerline poll fault at fault. Powerline poll at fault in biggest wildfire in Texas history report
that reminds
says.
Me of there's
an investigation by the Forest Service and the Smokehouse Creek Fire, which is the biggest one, said that a pole had broken off at ground level. So that's a very convenient narrative. And yeah, as convenient because it's, like you just said, it's the same narrative that was given about Hawaii. Power right. lines. So,
interesting.
They're talking here about, in order to explain what Abbott was talking about there, as in the extent of the destruction, you know, there's people who, there's emergency, you know, fire departments and stuff and fire experts who go to these things all the time, right? Abbott isn't an expert, I suppose, but he's been around and looked at these things and even he noticed that there's something strange about these fires. And then the same was the case in Hawaii, strange fires. So it's interesting that the explanation, the ultimate explanation, goes to electrical. That there had to be some, okay, electrical power lines, whatever, can start fires, but it's kind of interesting that it involves something, because obviously power lines would heat up to create fires or create initial fires at a much higher temperature than gasoline or something like that. You know, I mean, the actual intensity of the burner, their ability to actually start and perpetuate a fire from a power line would be much more effective than just gasoline. You know, especially in the context of where they happened, where there wasn't a drought, there was like maybe lack of rain further south, but not in the area where these fires in the north of Texas, where these fires have been, particularly this one called the Smokehouse Creek fire. But the BBC is BBC Earth, yeah, BBC Earth.
Unfortunate name for a fire.
Yeah, Smokehouse Creek. BBC Earth, the worst wildfire in Texas history, has a complex link. Now, it's complex, which means we're going to have to jump through many, many different hoops in order to make this case. And it's kind of a long article, but why have fires in Texas been so bad? Texas generally receives more rainfall in summer, the warmest part of the year, and it is dry, but cold in winter and spring. In other words, key factors for fires do not line up perfectly. It's cold when it's dry, but wet when it's warm. The Smokehouse Creek fire followed an unusual weather pattern. Blah, 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 blah. Strong cold winds blew in. High temperatures and strong cold winds, blah, blah. Basically, it's this big long article to try and say the conditions for fires in this area of Texas were not, the condition was not suitable for fires in this part of Texas. So it's complex. But maybe it was climate change. I mean, climate change is complex. So we can just call it climate change. Even though the official conclusion is that a power line fell down and started these fires. Now, how do you blame a downed power line on climate change? Well, it's complex, Neil, okay? So don't even try and understand it. Climate change can cause power lines to fall over. That's all you need to know. Okay?
Yeah.
Move on.
The satellite or radar footage of how it started was pretty, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
It's a straight line, west to east. Now, it followed the wind pattern. It was blowing very strongly mm-hmm. in that direction initially. And then there was a change, and it was a north-south wind. And that line that had been created just... I suppose that's the natural part. But how did it create this line? It just... fires don't spread in that kind of way. It may follow an overall direction, the dominant wind, but it's going to spread out, mm-hmm. You know, left and right of that direction, depending on what's available to burn. But it formed a near perfect line.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't matter whether it hit greenery or an oasis, you know, a watering hole or whatever, and then a structure and then a dry part. It just said, I'm burning everything in this line.
Mm-hmm.
It looked a bit too unnatural.
Mm-hmm.
Just saying. That's just what saying. The radio
footage. So you're saying that the Jews are rather the aliens. Well, I think I need to correct you on that because...
I'm not saying that.
I heard you thinking
people
it.
People on the Twitter are thinking. It's the DEWs.
Let's have a listen to this.
Tonight, 8 months after that out-of-this-world testimony on Capitol Hill.
Were they, I guess, human or non-human biologics?
Non-human. The official word from the Pentagon, no dead alien bodies, no crashed alien craft, and no government cover-up. In a 63-page report, the DOD's UAP office saying they've interviewed more than 30 people, including heads of aerospace companies, CIA and defense officials, and found no credible first-hand information supporting the claims.
Claims of hidden programs are largely the result of circular reporting by a small group.
Also detailed, the government's long history with UFOs going back to the 40s, even touching on former President Bill Clinton's interest in Roswell. But the DOD insisting that was a mix of confusion over high-altitude test dummies, fatal plane crashes, and a program to detect nukes. But when it comes to some of the recent mysteries involving pilots or surveillance video, the report was short on specifics.
We have a serious issue that pilots are dealing with. They still don't know if these are potentially adversaries.
The report's response to the UFO hype,
Russians.
A long list of earthly explanations, saying there was no evidence of extraterrestrials, but a small
Birds.
Percentage of cases had potentially anomalous characteristics or concerning characteristics. Unless
Russians.
They're yes, there are still a number of cases under investigation, with the DOD saying they are now developing special sensor kits that they call gremlins to send out whenever new UFO hotspots are reported. Lester?
Thanks for watching. Stay updated about Center breaking kits. News and top stories on the...
Why did we watch that?
Well, just because if you were thinking that it was aliens that started the fires in Texas, that's just out from a couple of days ago, a new report saying there's no such thing as aliens.
Right.
UFOs don't exist. So just you can put that out of your mind now.
Yeah. The quote from the general or admiral, whatever it was, yeah, that's a circular reasoning. Like, you tell us there's something real, and then you say there isn't.
It's called
and
gaslighting.
Then you say there is, and then you say there isn't.
You're being gaslighted up the wazoo all over the place, on every area, from Ukraine to climate change to aliens to viruses.
To social justice.
Everything. You're being gaslighted.
Democracy.
Yes.
Your vote's important. Actually, it isn't. Actually, it is. Come back and vote.
Yeah.
Actually, it isn't. We just cancelled it. Actually, speaking of votes mattering or not, the far right has won in Ireland. There were two referenda yesterday in Ireland. I don't know. The fact that they even ran this at all in this climate just goes to show you how completely out of touch.
Out of touch. All politicians.
yesterday, Irish referendums, voters reject changes to family and care definitions. So what they've been doing piece by piece, beginning with abortion, divorce, I can't remember the other one, something else about marriage. Gay rights, full gay, gay marriage and stuff, is trying to change the constitution. And in Ireland, you can only change the constitution with a referendum. And they've had, a run of hits, good success, during, let's say, the progressive 2010s in Ireland, but it's not working anymore. This time they wanted to, the proposed 39th Amendment of the Constitution proposed to revise the definition of family to include, quote, durable relationships outside marriage, whereas in the Constitution, as currently stated, it's... A family is the marriage of a man and a woman. And it was rejected by, I'm not sure what the final tally is, but some districts...
80-20.
Were 80-20. It was, some were worse. I've seen up to 96% no. That was the 39th Amendment. They thought they'd do a double header and, get two for one. And so they had the 40th Amendment to the Constitution, which proposed to remove references to a woman's, quote, life within the home and, quote, duties in the home, and add a new article instead on, quote, care within the family. And that was soundly rejected as well.
Yeah,
I think this is just simply no protest. no. It just doesn't matter if it's reasonable or, yeah, that's kind of how things already are de facto, so let's change it de jure. People are just...
Yeah.
Here's a go ahead.
It was to remove a reference to marriage as the basis on which the family is founded and replace it with a clause that defined marriages and other durable relationships, as families. So marriage, a reference to marriage as the basis on which the family is founded, and instead add in that marriages and other durable relationships are the basis on which the family is founded. So durable relationships, what could that be?
Three men and a baby,
well,
for example.
Yeah. So that was the...
Here's a map of the results.
Yeah. And the CARE referendum was to delete a statement that mothers shall not be obliged by economic necessity to engage in labour to the neglect of their duties in the home. So that's in the Constitution, and they wanted to remove it. That mothers, i.e. mothers of children, shall not be obliged by economic necessity to engage in labour in a way that neglects their duties in the home. And people said, no, that should stay.
Finally, the woke train in Ireland has come to a halt. There's a map of the results. Orange is no, and blue is yes. And the blue is a little rich, ultra-liberal part of Dublin.
And it was only about 50-50 there anyway.
It was close. It was very close. It was almost total rejection nationwide. That's a beautiful thumping. But
I was going to say 80. Donegal was the highest. That's up in the northwest there. 84% voted against. Kevin Monaghan, the rest, other countries, 81%. But generally speaking, it was a big majority.
Joe's proud of that because that's where his people are from.
Hmm, some of them.
Good man. So, like I said, it's the first time that the government has lost a referendum table in a decade in Ireland. To be clear here, there was no campaign. The entire government, including the opposition parties, the entire media, all 10,000 NGOs were all yes, and they've been thumped. And already the dickheads are saying, you know, I think we may not have clarified to the people what we were trying to do.
Yeah.
So what if we go back to the drawing table and try again later?
Well, they're saying they won't, though.
The government Ireland has a history of getting a no and then coming back with it 2 years later, so we'll see. Or they'll just go the American route. They won't bother putting it to people, and they'll just, I don't know, hire activist judges, change the law administratively and so on and so forth by basically setting new precedents in court cases, and the Constitution be damned. But still, this, in a sense, this isn't anything to do with the wording of the Constitution. This was a protest vote. What was the turnout? I think it was just under half, so... You know, you didn't even get that many people out to vote. Ordinarily, in ordinary times, this thumping no in the run-up to the time limit for which an election must be called, because it's been 5 years. Oh, it hasn't. No, it's been 2020. The last election was on the eve of the first lockdown. So technically, no, the government could teeter on for another year, but ordinarily getting this kind of like total rejection, you should call an election. But we don't live in ordinary times. I think they're going to try and stick it out, probably like the British government too, through whatever storm or crisis is coming through this summer, probably sometime. That's a hell of a 3-1, 4-1. All your money, all your access, and remember, they've been calling these people like far right. Only far right people would say no to this, and then they get like,
so what's that, like
a fish in the face.
Well, that's 75% of the population, at least, you know. So, which is what the which was revealed as well, that 75% of the Irish population are far right, according to the government's definition of far right, because in a poll there last year, 75% said they wanted a reduction, no more, or serious reduction in immigration into the country, and that makes you far right. So, and here again, you see the same 75% of the population are far right and keeping sexist language in the Constitution, which is very bad. So, well, you just have to suck it up. Like, if 75% of your population are sexist far righters, then what are you going to do? Put them on boats, send them to America to join Trump, like their ancestors did. Get out. Leave the 25% radical liberals in the country and see how they get on.
Not unless the 75% get there first.
Yeah. Well, where would you send the 25% of the radical lefties?
To England.
To the Elysee.
To Ukraine.
Yeah, to Ukraine.
One other topic I'd like to mention, that the chaos in Haiti. The reporting on social media is like cannibal gangs marauding. I'm like,
cannibals?
Yeah, cannibal gangs specifically. Mm. You know, cannibal gangs have taken over and they're eating and raping people, and Haiti's just gone to hell because they're cannibals. It's kind of this is actually somewhere where the woke left might have a point about subconscious racism, people, because it just took 10 minutes of looking for me to realize it's not just, they're not gangs to start with. Some of them are. But for example, the leader of one of them, Jimmy Cherizier, is a former cop, and he's the son of a police chief. Now, his nickname is Barbecue, which is not a good... And there are rumors, you know, because Haiti is in chaos and has been, obviously, for a long time.
Since the Americans overthrew Aristide.
Right. You can pick a date earlier or later. That's one of them. This guy, this probably the biggest quote-unquote gang leader, Jimmy Cherizier, right there on his Wikipedia page, quotes from him. He's, as far as he's concerned, he's the leader of a revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Cannibal gang leader? I'm not, no. Don't know what. That sounds like Western media perspective shifting or narrative manipulation there. Mm. So the current impasse in Haiti actually erupted a month ago. Although this week it's much more intense because the prime minister can't get back into the country. So this is from... early February. Haiti has been engulfed in unrest since Monday, with thousands of people in the city and the rest of the country demanding that the Prime Minister Henri step down in line with the political agreement forged in 2022. This guy did say he would have called elections by now. When the deadline was last week.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was last month, actually, and he's still technically the Prime Minister. look at this third paragraph there. This is a month ago. A police source said the five agents of the National Agency for Protected Areas, an armed government bureau now in open rebellion, had been shot Wednesday after refusing to drop their weapons and firing in the direction of police. So... that's civil war. That's not gangs per se. However, there are also criminal gangs. And yes, in Haiti, given all the crap that's happened there in recent decades, at this point, sometimes you can't put a paper between who is an actual street gang criminal organization and who is the police, you know. Granted. At the time, though, this Al Jazeera report about last month's protest is an exception. They at least said thousands of protesters. Most of the media reports just said, oh, it's a few hundred. No, it's the country is in revolution mode, definitely. So what's happened this week is that this guy who they want to step down, Ariel Henry, he was kind of like, he was never elected. He's a caretaker prime minister following the assassination of the last caretaker president following the assassination of the last president, which happened in 2021, mm-hmm. Jovenel Moïse, the 43rd president of Haiti, was assassinated on 7 July 2021 in the middle of the night at his residence in the capital of Port-au-Prince by a group of, quote, 28 foreign mercenaries mm-hmm. who were never caught, or mm-hmm. at least some of them maybe were, they were Colombians, but they never found out or they never published who hired them to do it.
Americans,
most likely. That's 2021. You mentioned Aristide. Where do you start? In 2010.
It was 2004.
That was 2004, right. Okay, well, that's now known from partly confirmed in WikiLeaks cables that were released.
He said it that, himself.
He said that the CIA...
Democracy Now and stuff, that the Americans... Americans are all over the place. American troops are all over Port-au-Prince and stuff.
Yeah.
Port-au-Prince.
American troops, of course, U.S. Marines were pre-staged, weirdly, to land in Haiti the day after the earthquake there in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
It was very suspicious there, along with thousands of Clinton Foundation type NGO people
mm-hmm.
who, God knows what they got up to.
It's America's sphere of influence, you know.
Yeah, there's something about Haiti sure that they're obsessed with. You know, obviously it's within the Monroe Doctrine. That's our backyard.
Mm-hmm.
But is it...
What if Russia gets in there? Like they did in Cuba.
They've really like...
Put some nukes in there.
Yeah, it's similar to Cuba, the way they treat it. But it's even more chaotic and unstable. Anyway, at this point, and this is the press reporting, gangs were really... It's not so much gangs as... The rebel forces, which seem to be loosely allied with each other, but this is the direct quote, gangs now control 80% of the capital. Last week, they coordinated attacks to free people from prisons. That sounds like gangs freeing other criminals, but in those prisons are a lot of political prisoners,
mm-hmm.
you know. They attacked police stations, they got weapons, and now they're shooting each other. The reporting that Ariel Henry has fled the country, not exactly. They timed it when he was out of the country on a visit. He was on a visit to Kenya, of all places, trying to get maybe African support to bring troops over to help him control or pacify the country, because Haiti has erupted many times before now in the most recent years. So whoever organized that while he was out was smart. That wasn't, you know, just gangs acting spontaneously.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a civil war type situation. It's what's happening there is all very political and tactical rather than just, you know, gang street warfare. Here's an interesting one. This guy is obviously turned native. Former United States Special Envoy for Haiti, Dan Foote. Here's what he told the BBC about what's happening. Here's how he characterize what's happening in Haiti to the BBC before they cut him off.
At this point, it's not a coup, it's not a protest, it's a revolution, I think. I believe the Haitians are really reaching out for the sovereignty that they did not gain when they defeated the French in 1804 for their independence, because ever since then, international countries and white people have been making their governmental decisions for them, and they've never had a social contract mm-hmm. between the people and their government.
Let me ask you then, what should the next move be for the prime minister? The U.S. has been urging him to step down to lay a path for new elections. Does he still have any legitimacy left, and what should he do?
He has zero legitimacy left, but there's a complicating factor. He's a suspect in the assassination of Jovenel Moïse, and I'm not sure he was involved in the planning or implementation, but he certainly has obstructed justice to a large degree since the assassination. And if he is no longer in power, he's going to have to face justice, and he knows that. So that complicates it. He's not getting back into Haiti and survive. And I'm not talking about survive as prime minister. I'm talking about survive a lot.
Right. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. So this guy is, according to Dan Foote, implicated in that assassination in 2021.
Who's the American's man? Yeah.
Yeah.
Like you said, it's been run by... He's been run
so
by...
So if he was American's man, Americans and this French. Is a revolution, then this is a legit revolution.
Yeah.
Hence, they're mischaracterizing it as gangs. And worse than that, on social media, the amplifiers, the so-called awake and aware people, you wouldn't believe who's saying this shit. Like, they're saying it's not just gangs. It's cannibal gangs.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going around eating and burning people.
But that's the jungle, right? It's part of the jungle outside of the civilized West. And, of course, the French have been all over. I mean, the French is, France's history in Haiti is, as Yaman just said, goes back from the very creation of the country. And, I mean, it's pretty much French-speaking, everything. Everything's named in French in the place, you know. So, but that's how you characterize it. Whenever a subservient or a client country and client population of Western powers decide that they don't want to be subservient anymore, then they're characterized as gangs and cutthroat rebels and cannibals and stuff like that, you know. So,
And the thing is, there are some facts on the ground that justify that. There are elements of that in it. Because the country is in such a dire state, because of overthrowing, you know, poverty,
because of
the earthquake, everything else. Trump, you know, what he said about Haiti is true. It's a shithole. That is objectively true, and at the same time, there are real people there, for God's sake. Don't just, you know, they're not, you know.
Yeah, just cast them aside,
Yeah. One final item for me. This was a hell of a headline. I scanned through it. It's a huge article. Big, big spread in The Atlantic last week. Just look at that title, though. What the hell are they saying? That's not a fake headline. That was March 4th, Atlantic publication. The golden age of American Jews is ending. Anti-Semitism on the right and the left threatens to bring to a close an unprecedented period of safety and prosperity for American Jews and demolish the liberal order they helped establish.
So it's back to pogroms then.
That's kind of insinuated throughout the article, but
anti-Semitism on the right and left.
Well, the left would be obvious. That would be the pro-Gaza support.
That's anti-Semitic.
Well, they've gone and equated it, yeah. They believe that to be the case now. Look at Gad Saad and the moderates like him. And then on the right, certainly, we've seen that on Twitter recently. But that's also a consequence of what's going on with Israel. So the two things are definitely connected. It's interesting that they have... And the liberal order they helped establish, but liberalism is such a dirty word now, you know. But that's not officially the case yet, because they haven't allowed a free and fair election yet in the West. There have been a few, but we'll see. I just thought it was interesting that they themselves are going to make that connection, sort of almost structurally, that the world as you knew it was... one that was good for this small minority. In fact, they helped create it. And that's going away now.
The Jews are behind liberalism. That's what the article said. The liberal order that they established. Yeah.
Well, is that not anti-Semitism?
It's a bit anti-Semitic.
What they're positing there?
I'd give that 3 out of 5. Three anti-Semitism.
I suppose they're saying, Jews... you know, not control, let's say that control is a negative word. Jews are, you know...
conspired to...
No, conspire is negative as well. No conspiracy.
They helped to create...
But they're saying, yes, it's true, but it's good.
Yeah.
And that it will no longer be the case is bad.
Mm.
So it's like you're admitting what the core thing that you say is anti-Semitism, which is that Jews control the world.
But I didn't say that. They helped create a liberal order.
And that this time has been a golden age for them.
Yeah. Just accidentally. Yeah, no, but I can see, it depends how you phrase it, but I would still give that headline.
Three out of five.
Three anti-Semitisms out of a possible maximum five anti-Semitisms.
Okay. It didn't quite go all the way, but yeah.
But with a few changes of words here and there, you know, instead of help create, conspired to create, then you would have what, four?
Yeah. I hope it was written carefully. It's 10,000 words. I might read it more carefully.
Hmm.
It might go up to four anti-Semitism.
You might get four anti-Semitisms. Anyway, I think we're going to leave it there because we're all done. We've talked about all the nonsense we could possibly talk about in the period of time that we've been talking. So, we've been anti-Semitic, been racist, been sexist,
far right.
We've been far right, and that's just by talking about the news without actually, explicitly saying anything along those lines, which, you know, it's interesting that when you just talk about the news and you check all the boxes for those evils of today. We can't do any more. We shouldn't do any more in case we get shut down or something.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's climate change. Just you sitting here breathing and talking, Joe, you caused the Texas wildfire.
Yeah, at least contributed to them, yeah. Conspired to contribute to them. You know that I only know 25 letters of the alphabet?
That's all there is, isn't there? There's more. How many are there?
I think we'll leave it there for a second, folks.
Come on, what's the punchline?
Now yours is funnier. Yours is funnier. No, the punchline is, I don't know why.
I'm good with words, just not letters.
Yeah, just even the words, just not interpreting them properly. Anyway, we'll leave it there for this week, folks. Thanks for listening, watching, and commenting. We'll be back next week with another show. So until then, have a good one. See ya. Bye.
Bye, all. See ya.
Can't stop the signal now.